there was a rock that was, it was like 400 pounds, and I had to go up this chimney, and it was right in front of me, and it was rubbed smooth from all the people that had gone over it. People have been going over it since the 80s, but three people in front of me went over it, and when I went over it, I grabbed it, and the rock just came out and started like falling towards me in the chimney, so I had to like fall out of the chimney to avoid the rock, and luckily I didn't have any major, just cuts and scrapes.
Wow, that's lucky.
Yeah, very lucky.
Sometimes you can get a place, it's like, if I break my leg, it's going to be hard to get out.
Dude, the rescue, literally the rescue plan in Jewel Cave, the one by the park service, is to get a drilling rig and drill a hole. That's the rescue plan. Like, it is that arduous of a task to get back there.
I am talking to Ian Chechet, a caver, the president of the Northern Rocky Mountain Grotto, and one of the last remaining true explorers. He is one of the very few people who has ever been to the bottom of the Tears of the Turtle Cave. Tears of the Turtle Cave is the deepest cave in the continental U.S. and the deepest limestone cave in the whole United States. The arduous journey took him deep into the Bob Marshall Wilderness of Montana. The current depth of the cave is at 1,863 feet, and it continues to be explored deeper. The cave is insane and pushes humans to their very limits. You are listening to the Mountains and Mushrooms podcast.
I watched your presentation on Tears of the Turtle Cave, and it was brutal. It looked brutal. So it begs the question, why are you caving?
that's a great question, Austin. I started caving in about 2010, and the reason was because a friend and I were going to go climb to the top of Avalanche Peak in Yellowstone Park. It's just outside the Cody entrance, and this was in August. It was a free day, so we're like, cool, that's what we'll go do. And we get partway up to the top of Avalanche Peak, and then it's snowing, brutally snowing, to the point that there's a ranger up there being like, you can't go up there anymore. And so we're like, we're kind of, you know, and smart. I'm sure it would have been really dumb for us to be on top of a mountain in like these crazy conditions. So we came back down and we were feeling really unfulfilled, you know, like we just didn't get to do what we wanted to do. And on the way back home to Billings, we saw something about Big Ice Cave in the Pryor Mountains. So we're like, oh, okay, that's just like 10, 15 miles off the road. We'll just swing through really quick. And 3.5 hours later, we got to the entrance of Big Ice Cave. And, you know, you could drive right to it, but it's a very, very slow road. Cuts through the Crow Reservation for a while. It's really, really slow. It's undrivable when it's wet. We got up to the Big Ice Cave, and I was just instantly hooked. I was like, wow, this is so cool. This is an amazing feature. You can slide around on this, like, 75-foot big patch of ice, maybe larger. There's a room underneath that's got a gate that you can't quite get to. And I was just like, wow, this is really cool. I was just amazed. And then I could tell I was hooked because that fall, that winter, I was on Google Earth, like looking through the Pryors, looking for caves. I called up the local forest service and was like, where are all the caves? And they're like, I actually spoke with Dan Seifert in out of the Red Lodge office. And he pointed me towards the Grotto and towards the Caves of Montana publication from the School of Mines.
That's like the caving Bible.
Yeah, for Montana, it absolutely is. Yeah, so that's how I started caving. And I didn't really have a super strong outdoor background at that point. I was had moved from Wisconsin a couple years earlier. But all of a sudden I moved to Montana and I was like, oh, I'll go a little hiking and a little biking. And then I found caving and I was like, wow, this is all just a means to go caving. And I was just totally hooked. And that's how I got into caving.
When I did Bighorn Caverns, I had the Caves of Montana book and I looked at that map in there and it was tiny compared to the map you guys had. You guys had mapped out or somebody had in the past. So things have really developed with caving.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that cave system, the Bighorn Horse Thief cave system, the story there is just really, really fun too. That cave system was, if I don't know if you've seen this, there was an NSS convention in Lovell, Wyoming, and I think it was 69, something like that. And yeah, that was the big thing. It's like, come check out Bighorn Caverns. We just, you know, we're just still exploring it and mapping it. So the map that you saw, the one you saw in Newell Campbell's book, I think Caves of Montana is from 78, something like that. So it's, yeah, it's just, they were very much still exploring the cave. There's a bunch of it that hadn't been discovered yet. Horse Thief Cave, it was still just 800 feet long, you know, 900 feet long. That crawl at the back hadn't been opened up yet. So yeah, there's a lot of exploration and discovery that's continued to go on in that area that's led to that map that you see now. And I think that map was pioneered by the Northwest Cave Research Institute in the late 80s. And then there were a lot of other folks that helped out with that independent of that group too. But there's actually talk right now of when COVID's over and we can all start assembling, one of the things that's going to be the best for the grotto is to have a big project. So we're even, you know, that map that you saw from the 80s is still lacking a lot of things that a modern map would have. And not that they did anything wrong. It's just standards have changed since then. So there's talk of to kind of help re-energize the grotto. If we can find someone to lead it, we'd like to just start remapping that cave. And that would just be a tremendous amount of effort and just hanging out with friends, you know? So yeah, hopefully we can help steer the grotto in that direction and maybe make that happen. Cause it's, you know, it's one of the most phenomenal cave systems in the West, in my opinion. So I think it definitely deserves a worthy map.
Have you worked on mapping a few caves?
Yeah. I actually, the first time I started mapping caves, the first cave I ever mapped in was French Creek Cave. That's a cave that we don't have access to right now. It's also, it's one of the more interesting caves in Montana that I'm aware of. It's entirely in black dolomite, and that cave, it's in southwest Montana outside Dillon, and an old gold mine at it intersected cave passage. So the people that own that gold mine at it aren't letting us access it right now. But I started mapping. That was actually one of the things that really was invigorating the grotto in the early 2000s was access to that cave and that mapping project. So I started there, and then I went to Jewel Cave, and I mapped with Lee Gray and some other folks in Jewel Cave. And that really got me started on mapping and kind of taken and run with it now. So I've been lucky enough to map caves in many states across the country, from Kentucky to New Mexico to it's really fun, and kind of one of the evolutions that happens with caving for a lot of folks is that they start caving just to like see what's there, right? It's amazing. You're going in this Dr. Seuss world. You're like, where everything's different, the smells are different, the sights are different, like the colors are different. It's just all different, right? So it's this amazing experience just going caving. But eventually a lot of people tend towards project caving, and that's just where it's like, okay, we're going caving, but what are we going to do when we're there? Are we going to map the cave? Are we going to try and take some scientific measurements? Are we going to, you know, are we going to take a biologist there and help them look for bats? Are we going to install a cave register? Like, what are we doing when we're there? So that's kind of one of the evolutions that's happened with me, and what happens with a lot of folks as they continue to cave. So then you just get more of a directed purpose, and we start calling ourselves speleologists and thinking we're like making the world a better place. And
what does it feel like to be inside of a cave?
That's a great question. I love the feeling inside of a cave because it's completely different. You're 100% isolated from the outside world. You know, sometimes we talk about, like, we'll go on an 8-day underground trip, and it's like, wow, I mean, there could have been a nuclear war and we wouldn't know. Nothing would be different where we're at right now. You know, is anything going to be different when we come out? So when you're underground, you're so isolated that you're never thinking, oh, did I pay the bill for the electric, or, you know, like, is my cell phone, but yeah. You know, like, what's everything, because you're so isolated and you're in such a different world where the smells are different, the colors are different, everything feels different. The only thing that matters is really what's in front of you. So when you're underground, you know, like you're just paying attention to what's in front of you very much. You're so focused on the present. And I think that that's really cool. And I think that that's something that we kind of lack in society. And, you know, I think people that are hikers and just wilderness explorers would probably empathize with some of those real similar feelings.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But just having, being away from the sun and having that sensory deprivation is, it's really mild at first, but over time you start to notice it a little bit. And then when you come back out, you're just overwhelmed with, like, the grass is so green and it smells so good. And it's just, you know, it's, you realize how you can take that stuff for granted a little bit when you don't have it for several days.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So how long have you been in a cave before?
Yeah. So the longest I've spent underground is in a Falls Cave in the Grand Canyon in Arizona. And that was 8 days, 7 nights. And I've also done that same time in Lechuguilla Cave in New Mexico for 8 days, 7 nights.
Wow. Does it get to you eventually after 8 days, or?
You know, that's a good question. I was concerned about that going, you know, on my first cave camping trip, because you hear, like, oh man, am I going to get the rapture of the deep, or, like, you know, am I going to start to, cause some people do. I personally, for myself, I didn't feel any of that. I just, after 8 days underground, it's like, I wanted to leave. Like Lechuguilla Cave is 99% humidity. 68 degrees. So imagine, you know, like 8 days in that environment, sweating, like it's the grossest I've ever been my whole life. So I was ready to leave, but I was ready to leave like just on the same, like I would be ready to leave after 8 days hiking in the mountains and being gross. You know, you just kind of like, yeah. You just like, okay, this is awesome. I'm excited that I did this adventure and I'm ready to move on. You know, like that's kind of how I didn't feel any different than just like a wilderness trip you'd feel, where it's nice to leave, but it's nice to come back to.
So you never have to face the feeling of claustrophobia ever?
So when I first started caving, I was really claustrophobic. Really? And yeah, and the way, just going through like the Denise's Crawl in Horse Thief Cave, there's parts of that where I would have to wait and I'd let the person ahead of me go all the way through so that way I could go through the scary part as quick as I could. You know, yeah, like I remember doing that. And just what helped me with it is I was motivated, you know. I wanted to see what was on the other side, and then just having people go ahead of me. So it's like, you know, okay, Greg went through, I know I can go through, you know? So just that kind of attitude and mentality. And over time, it just became less of a thing. Now I still sometimes feel claustrophobia, and I know for a lot of my peers, it seems like as we get older, claustrophobia is maybe one of those things that starts creeping back in a little bit more.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So I have some friends that have been caving for a while and are in their 40s now and are like, I don't really want to do that squeeze that I know I can do and I've done a bunch, because it's pretty uncomfortable and a little scary. And yeah. So it's kind of interesting how that perspective shifts.
You get yourself into some tough spots. Do you ever feel like you might not ever get back out?
Never more so than the bottom of Tears of the Turtle.
So could you explain a little bit about Tears of the Turtle?
Yeah, certainly. So Tears of the Turtle is the deepest cave in the 48 right now. It's about, I don't have the exact number, but it's about 1,800 or 1,900 feet deep. There's 50 some rope drops to get to the bottom of the cave, but just to get to the entrance is a 60-mile drive down a dirt road and then a 24-mile hike through the wilderness. So it's a pretty arduous trek just to get to the cave. And then you get to the bottom, there's 50 some rope drops. There's a lot of squeezes. The cave averages, it's a mile, almost a mile and a half long. It averages 2 feet wide. So it's 2 feet wide, 30 feet tall. And sometimes that 2 foot wide part is 15 feet up, 20 feet up. So you're like in this narrow crack and you have to stem in this muddy crack, you know, and you're like trying not to slide down in the bottom of this keyhole wedge. You're covered in the slickest mud you've ever experienced. And that's what most of the cave is like. There are parts where it's bigger, parts where it's smaller, but that's just like a good average of the cave. So it's mentally trying, fatiguing. It's just it's one of the toughest things I've ever done. And people that are way tougher than me say it's one of the toughest things that they've ever done too.
Wow. I was on the understanding that it's still potentially going on, right? You can only make it so far.
Yeah, so we in 2016, we set up a camp in there because we were reaching the limits of human endurance doing day trips to the bottom of the cave and back with some of the toughest cavers in America, and that I'm aware of, at least. So those guys, we set up camp in 2016 to make it easier for us, and we continued to find more passage at the bottom. In 2019, the same thing happened. They set up a camp, continued to map and explore more passage on the bottom. The cave is still going on with airflow and water at the bottom that we don't know where it's going or what it's trending, or it's possible that so we're approaching, the cave is approaching the level of the White River. It's at the bottom. It's, I think, maybe 100 feet or so away. So what that, it could mean two things, basically. It's going to either hit water table around there and sump out, or what could happen, and this is speleogasming, but it could, that river could be a perched water table, and there could be cave passage underneath that river. And sometimes in these types of situations, that river is actually like an indentation that's related or formed or somehow related to like passage underneath, like trunk passage underneath. No idea what the case is going to be. One of the craziest things is that the Silvertip cave system, which is the longest cave system entirely in Montana, is 7 miles away, and it's on the same spine of mountains. So you just go 7 miles straight south along the spine of mountains, and there's the Silvertip cave system, and it very much resembles the Tears of the Turtle cave, where there's a lot of different infeeders. There's Tears of the Turtle, and there's another cave system called Virgil the Turtle, and another one called Tickle Me Turtle, and another one called there's a bunch of different turtle cave systems that all end by getting too tight with airflow at the bottom. If that was Silvertip, those passages would just go to one main big trunk passage. So it's possible, since this is the same geology, same area, that these are all leading into one big trunk passage. And if that's the case, it's probably going to be the hardest cave in the world, is honestly what it could lead to being. There was a caver who visited Tears of the Turtle in 2019. He's also visited the deepest cave in the world, which is Voronezh Cave in Russia. It might have been recently surpassed by another one, but she was at Tears of the Turtle. She was one of the people that camped at the bottom of the cave, and she said if Tears of the Turtle goes a few hundred feet deeper, it'll be the hardest cave in the world. Yeah, so it's just, every time we go into that cave, we're like, can we find the bottom? Will it stop? You know, we don't want it to keep going, we also have this inane desire to know what's on the other side. So
yeah, absolutely. What is it like to be in a spot that potentially no one has ever been to before? You are a true explorer.
It's what drives a lot of cavers. That feeling and that opportunity is what drives a lot of us. I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it right now. I mean, I'm really lucky. I've been on trips in some amazing caves where I've been the first one there, and what that means, Austin, is for the rest of eternity, my footprints are the footprints that other people have to follow. You know, like those like,
yeah,
it's
absolutely
just,
that's true.
It's an amazing, you know, like what my light is showing light on has never seen light before. You know, it's this crazy experience. And once in a great while, we get lucky and we find some really weird stuff.
What's some of the coolest stuff you have found or seen in a cave?
Yeah. So, I've been, one of the coolest things that I've found, I think, is in a cave in the Grand Canyon. A double bopper cave. It's over 40 miles long now. We rappelled down into a lower level of this cave that no one had been in, and we started mapping, and we found a 2 to 3 foot long corpse of an animal, fully articulated. Wow. Skeleton. There was mummified skin on it. There's some hair, and it had giant canines. And we at one point we're like, we found a wolverine, and we thought there was a good chance that we found a wolverine. And we got out and we're like, wow, this is going to extend the historical southern boundary of the wolverine. Like, we are like true scientists. We brought back a paleontologist, and it turns out it was a raccoon. Yeah. Which is still phenomenally cool. You know, it's still absolutely way cool. Sometimes I've been through passages in that same cave, Double Bopper, where there are prints down the passage, but not people prints, because no human's been down it. There are ringtail cat tracks through the cave.
Wow.
We've got, there's that cave in particular is one of the coolest things that I've seen. There's probably 100,000 mummified bats throughout this cave. Wow. So sometimes you're crawling down passages and you're just like, oh, there's a little bat. You just move them out of the way. It weighs like a gray, you know, nothing. It weighs like a paperclip, nothing. And they're still hanging on the wall in a lot of cases. This cave system also has more gypsum flowers than maybe any other cave. So a lot of times there's bats still hanging on gypsum flowers. And there's been some samples taken by the University of Arizona, and I believe they're working on radiocarbon dating them.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's really fascinating. But I mean, those caves in the Grand Canyon have some of the coolest stuff ever, man. Like archaeo stuff, split twig figurines. There's woven 4,000-year-old woven baskets that predate pottery technology.
Really?
There are caves in the Grand Canyon that the entire floor is littered in giant sloth poop. The whole floor of the cave is covered in extinct giant sloth poop. Like, those caves in the Grand Canyon are in some of the coolest stuff that I've been lucky enough to help out with, in my opinion.
That sounds awesome. I've heard that caves are, you know, you can sometimes find really ancient animals and artifacts just because nothing ever rots away if they ever find themselves down in there.
Have you seen, they just found 20 to 25,000 year old stuff in a cave in Mexico, which is pushing back the date of human habitation in North America. But I think that this is pretty conclusively, like, I think it's like the science is pretty well accepted at this point with that particular study. So yeah, you're exactly right.
Is that one of the cenotes?
I don't think that, no, that wasn't a cenote. That was a above ground cave somewhere.
Oh, wow.
And then I also saw this past year that they, in Australia, they found Aboriginal stuff in caves out there dating to like 100,000 years or something, like way old, that pushes that timeline back quite a ways too. Yeah, so I agree. It's the caves are finding all kinds of cool stuff. That's some of the best place to find ancient archaeological history, I think.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's cool. I was also reading that in caves you can find species that are still alive, but they're not found anywhere else because they have evolved and bred all within this confine away from everything else.
Yeah, they're called extremophiles, and I've been lucky enough to see the coolest ones that I've seen are in Binkley Cave in Indiana. And in that cave, we're just going along, and there's white crawfish that they're just like swimming along. You can scoop them up and look at them, and they don't have any eyes at all. Like they just have like lids where their eyes would be. And same, there's some fish in there too that are also white like that.
That's super bizarre. That's crazy. It's like an alien world.
Man, I'm telling you, it's really like a Dr. Seuss world when you go caving. It's just, it feels like an alternate universe. And that's, I think, the appeal to a lot of us nerds that really undertake it.
If someone's interested in getting into caving, whether they're from Montana, Wyoming, or anywhere else, how would you recommend them to get into it?
That's a great question. And I'm going to preface that a little bit with caves. Like we were just talking, caves are great records of history. And the reason for that is because they're incredibly static. They do not change. So if we go into a cave, it's only changing because we're in there. So because of that, cavers are pretty protective of caves. We don't want to just say like, hey, here's where all the caves are, go explore them, because a lot of people that don't realize how easily impacted they are don't understand that that handprint that they put there is going to be there for 100,000 years maybe, or maybe forever. So with that in mind, you know, there's not like just a database that people should go to and it's like, here's all the caves, you know, here's... So what we try to do is we try to build a community instead of just having a list of caves. So the National Speleological Society, the NSS, their website is caves.org, has a list of all the local organizations, we call them grottos, across the country. So I would encourage folks, the first step that I would make is to join a grotto or go to a grotto meeting. You don't even have to join. If you're lucky enough to be in an area that has a lot of caves, there's probably a lot of grottos. Go to different ones. Some are going to be more active. Some are just going to talk about the good old days of what caving used to be. And so some are going to be somewhere in between. So I would say find a group like that. And those people, they're going to have caves that are going to be appropriate for someone who is still learning the ropes, you know, literally and figuratively. And they're going to help guide you so you can become a responsible caver. And that's that would be how I would encourage folks to get started. When I first found out about caving and I called the Forest Service and they're like, join the grotto, I was hesitant. I waited like a year to do that. And in hindsight, I just put myself back a year, you know? So yeah. I wish I would have done that a little sooner. It is. And back when I joined, I think we had like 20 some members and I had to mail a check to Missoula. So we've tried to enhance our digital infrastructure a little bit, you know, and I make it less intimidating, but yeah, it's intimidating. And showing up at an event with a bunch of strangers, who wants to do that? That's kind of scary. So we try to just, instead of having more formal meetings in Montana, we try to host regional pub nights. So that way, you know, just show up at the bar, you know, just talk, what the plans are. And that makes it a little more informal and I think less scary, but it also makes it less reliable because it's just, you know, whenever some local person plans pub night. So kind of tough.
I didn't realize there was only 20 members when you joined.
Yeah, it might have been 30, but it was pretty low back then in the very early 2000s. And they just had meetings in Missoula. I think every couple months they would have a Missoula based meeting.
How many members do you have now?
I think we have 220, somewhere around there. It's above 200. And you know, that really, the membership really started blowing up when Daryl Greaser got us a website. He built a website that was very modern and then that you could join online. I think that makes it a little less intimidating to just be able to click a button at least and have people kind of get ushered into the culture that way.
What are some of the prospects you're looking forward to in the next coming years, next year, the year after, for caving anywhere in the world?
Yeah, so one of the things that I would really like to cave, I've got a friend who's been caving in Belize, and I've heard wonderful things about caving in Belize. The culture, the people, just everything is really great. And they desperately need people who are surveyors, so that means that I can get on the trip because I know how to map. encourage, you know, just a plug there for people who looking for something. You know, you can get on a lot more trips if you know how to map. So that's a good thing. So I think Belize is someplace I'd like to go. I also hear really great things about Cuba, the caves in Cuba, the cavers in Cuba, the culture of Cuba. I think Cuba would be a really good place. Malaysia is a place that Jason, my friend Jason Polinski, has gone quite a bit, and he says the caves there are, you know, world class. I mean, some of the larger caves I think in the world are out there. So those are some of the places internationally that I think I'd be interested in. Of course, there's Canada, where they have the deepest cave north of Mexico, which they can just helicopter to check it out. We do this like 24 mile hike through the wilderness. They go like 15 minute helicopter flight from to this like amazing plateau in the mountains. So So that seems really cool. And then just looking more just in the U.S., I love going to the Bob Marshall. I'd like to go back to the Bob Marshall caving or pack rafting or a combination of the two this coming summer. And then New Mexico or caving in Arizona. I love caving in the Grand Canyon. So I try to go caving in the Grand Canyon every year. So I expect to do that again this year. I'd like to go caving in New Mexico.
The grotto down there? What's the grotto down there?
That's a good question. I am not part of the grotto down there. Normally I am part of like other regional grottos nearby. And then when I'm going to travel, I'll just either already know someone out there or, you know, you'll reach out to the grotto and be like, hey, I'm going to be in this area if anybody wants, you know, but I, if I joined every grotto that I interacted with, I'd have no cash, I think.
Do you think there are quite a few caves still to be discovered in Montana, in Wyoming?
In one word, yes. Yes, there are quite a few caves to be discovered in Montana and in Wyoming. There are also quite a few passages in existing caves to be discovered in Montana and in Wyoming. I think that as technology continues to evolve, we're going to see a lot of a lot more stuff showing up. Specifically, one of the technologies that is huge right now, and I was this past summer, I was lucky enough to take part in a project like this, where we use LIDAR technology that's gathered by the USGS, and I have a friend, Philip Schuthart, who can run that. He created a filter and runs it through a filter, so it just takes and highlights all the pits that the LIDAR technology pulls out everything else and is just like, here's all the pits. This one's 20. We went to one in northern Idaho that LIDAR identified as being 60 some feet deep, and we found a 200 and some feet deep cave that it looked like no one had been into since the 80s, maybe. There was like an old cave register in a Cool Whip container that had like a 1980s copyright on it, and no one we know is aware of that cave, so like maybe it's been lost or maybe it's really secret or something, but yeah, I mean, so that technology is one example. I think gravitational anomalies is a little bit further out, but that's one that they're also going to be able to use to find caverns and voids. Ground penetrating radar is another one that's just getting out there that, you know, we're going to be able to use. Okay, here's a sinkhole, let's put the GPR over it. Okay, there's a void 10 feet deep. Let's get a shovel, you know? Like, I think that technology, along with drone technology, is really going to help out with finding new caves, and just more people out there too. You know, there's more and more people. So there's more and more, there's just more and more folks recreating in the mountains. There's more and more hunters going off the beaten path, you know? So I think more outreach is something else we can do for like some of these different organizations to be like, hey, have you seen a cave? We'll come check it out. And if it's a big one, we'll name it after you or something like that, you know? Like, so I think
there you go. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, exactly. So I think those are some of the ways that we're going to continue to find caves. But some of the people that have done a lot, if you look at Newell Campbell, just recently, he's the one who wrote Caves of Montana. He just recently wrote an updated Caves of Montana, Here's Where to Go to Find Caves. And we posted that on the website. So that's one of the more recent articles on the website, if you look.
That was awesome.
Yeah, even the guy who wrote the book on Cave It in Montana is still publishing articles about there's more caves out there, guys. He wrote that book in a year and a half, man. Like,
wow. Really? Yeah. So you think he surveyed and mapped all those caves in a year and a half?
Yeah, like under 2 years, I believe.
Yeah,
he gathered that data a lot. Yeah, I mean, exactly. So, yeah, isn't that phenomenal? Like, that guy, I mean, talk about being busy. But, yeah, there's still, and of course, he cherry-picked all the easiest, best stuff, right? Because that's what it was back then. But, yeah, there's still a lot more to find.
The Bob is a crazy place. I went whitewater rafting last summer. And among whitewater rafters, there's a story that supposedly a bank robber in Kalispell stole a bunch of money back in the day, cowboy times, went out into the Bob and hid it in a cave somewhere. And so people that whitewater raft, oftentimes, if they see like a little hole up by the river, they'll go over and try to find it.
Really?
So, Yeah, maybe you'll find it someday. I don't know.
Well, that see, like what I hear, I know it's funny. You say that most people hear, ooh, treasure. What I hear is, ooh, a whole bunch of people have already checked leads. Can we get their beta?
Yeah, absolutely. That's true.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's just throw that out there to the whitewater rafting community. If they find any caves that seem really cool or really deep or anything like that, or have a lot of airflow or sound like they have running water in it or anything like that, like let us know because we are super interested.
That'd be cool. Yeah. Yeah. Do you do a lot of networking and reaching out?
You know, I'd like to really do more. I think that that's going to be a part of the way of the future, is doing that. And traditionally, historically, the NRMG has done a really good job of reaching out and working with our federal partners and our state partners. But I think that's one thing that we could do better is reaching out and working with other groups like hunters and the backcountry woodsmen and outdoorsmen and, you know, like some of these whitewater groups. And I think that that's definitely something that we can do better. And we are a part of the we're an affiliate of Montana Wildlife Association. So that is one of the ways that we have been reaching out and working with other orgs. But yeah, that's definitely something that we want to expand upon.
That's awesome. I've heard that there might be a movie being filmed or a TV show, a documentary on caving.
Yes.
Part of that.
So there is a gentleman out of Great Falls who's a film producer who's worked with Netflix and Amazon and some of these other large organizations, and he is pitching. He's already made a sizzle reel. He's pitching a show that would be like the Alex Honnold Yosemite show. Yeah, he's trying to do one like that with this Tears of the Turtle expedition. So if he gets someone to fund that, there's definitely some challenges associated with filming in the wilderness and everything like that. But he thinks that he can overcome that, and we can get the permits that we need to accomplish that. So if that's the case, it's possible that later this year in 2021, the summer, that there will be a documentary filmed for the continued exploration of Tears of the Turtle. It's still kind of up in the air. If that happens, I hope to be one of the antagonists who is just there on the, you know, on the casting couch being like, oh, look at these dummies. They're never going to, you know, just joking like that kind of. That's, I believe, what my role is going to be after my completed expedition in 2016.
You have no ambition to go deeper into that cave?
No, and most people that have been to the bottom are like, oh man, why would I go back? so yeah, it's not anything. I've kind of checked that box, and I'm glad to have done it, and I have no desire to be doing it again.
There's much more enjoyable caves, right?
Yeah, even just like we were talking about earlier, that Silvertip cave system 7 miles south. It's over 10 miles long. It's got 20 entrances, so there's just a million through trips you can do, like in one entrance, out another entrance. Camp is the most beautiful campsite I've ever probably sat at. It's you're like right at the edge of this cliff overlooking your entire 15-mile hike in. You can see all the way into Glacier National Park. It's this phenomenally just amazing experience. I saw a wolverine up there before. Like it's just this, everything up there is just amazing. It's just this wonderful type one. We get our we get all our water from Cheese Cave, which is 50 feet from camp, and we can also store all our beer in there because it's like a 30 some degree cave, so we have packers bringing beer for us. Like it's the most fun. Just everything's like fun while you're doing it, you know, instead of just suffering misery. It's really cold still. It's like 30 some degrees. It's really windy, so you know, like surveying in there is still not the. I mean, there's still some challenges associated with it. We have a lot of gear on to stay warm, but yeah, you can have so much more fun nearby. And really, the only reason to continue to explore Tears of the Turtle is to see what's there, or to prove how tough you are. One of the two, I think.
Get deeper.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to see what's around the corner, I understand that drive very much so, but I can tell you what's going to be around the corner. It's going to be about 2 feet wide, covered in mud, maybe a little bit of airflow. You know, that's so far, that's all we've seen in that cave.
How did you learn how to map and survey?
Yeah, so just other people, other cavers took me under their wing and showed me. And when we survey caves underground, it's a lot different and more difficult than it would be, you know, if we were just doing above ground survey, because you just use GPS, right? Like survey equipment above ground is real easy. But underground, what we do is it's basically a 3D game of connect the dots. So we take measurements and we put little dots on the cave wall so we know that that's the measurement, and then we draw the lines. So we'll take the inclination, the compass reading, and then the distance. And so we'll be able to draw a top view and a side view with those lines on it. And then we'll draw the cave relative to those dots. So we'll see at the dot, the ceiling's about 4 feet above it. So I'll draw the cave there. So we're trying to take and model two-dimensional views off of this three-dimensional object. So it's pretty abstract when you're doing it. But there's only one person that's doing that part of it. So that's the leader. The other people can be just entry level people that have very little experience, because they just have to get those dots. So you just always want to put those dots or those survey points in a spot where you can always connect into other passage. So if there's, you know, a side passage, you have to have a dot there. So then you can survey into that thing. And, you know, so it's a three person job usually. Two people running instruments, recording those measurements, and then marking the cave. And then the third person is actually writing down those numbers in the book and drawing the cave passage and features relative to all those cave measurements, those survey points.
That sounds immensely difficult, since it's such a labyrinth in there and you have no idea what's up or down, you know, which way you went a lot of times.
Yeah, I mean, and from that perspective, you're right. If you look at the man hours that go into surveying these longer systems, it's unfathomable. But it also is like, it's just one shot at a time is the other side of it. You know, you just show up there and it's just like, okay, I'm starting here, and it's very linear. You know, I go from here to here and here to here and here to here. So all of a sudden you've been surveying and you're like, wow, the most cave that I've ever mapped, I was on a 32-hour extended day trip on a cave in New Mexico, Fort Stanton Cave, where we explored and mapped it was 1.49 miles of cave passage, I believe, or 1.59. It was 8,600 feet of passage that we mapped and explored.
It's a long process, huh?
Yeah, just one shot at a time, you know? And that one
Although
was pretty
one
ideal.
Mile doesn't sound very long for like a hiker, but in a cave, that's a ways.
Yeah, exactly. When you think that, you know, the average survey shot is probably, depending on the cave, anywhere from 10 to 30 feet. So, wow. Yeah, this cave was a little special, so we had longer shots, but still, yeah, it was, it takes a while.
In Tears of the Turtle Cave, how much further did you guys extend where people had been before and mapped before?
I'm actually going to tell you the story of 2014 Tears of the Turtle. Before, I believe this was the 2014 trip. This might have been the 2012 trip, but the dates aren't very important. What was happening was Tears of the Turtle was so miserable. It was so miserable that everyone was going to quit, because all the other caves out there, they just get too tight, and they end where it gets too tight and you can't go on anymore, and that's the bottom of the cave. And it was more and more of that, and it was just so excruciatingly painful that they were like, we're gonna quit. So as true explorers, we have a mantra that we survey as we go. You know, so like we just like Lewis and Clark did when they went west, just like Columbus did, you know, like we're mapping as we're going, and this got so bad in 2014 that they were like, we quit. We're just not even going to map. We're just going to run. We're just going to squeeze down to the end of the cave, see what's back there, and never come back again. That's the plan. And then they found the borehole, the only part of the cave where it's big and wide and open. And without that, we wouldn't have a camp and we would not be exploring the cave any further. So they found the borehole, and that's what they were like, okay, we're going to come back. We're going to set up a camp in 2016. And that's what actually inspired that process.
So this borehole, it's not 2 feet wide like everywhere else. So you're able to sleep and have a tent.
Yeah, huh? Exactly. It's not 2 feet wide. It's maybe 40 feet wide and 40 feet tall and 200 feet long, 100 feet long, something like that. But it's covered in this boot-sucking mud that you can't really stand in. But luckily, on the side of the borehole, there's a bunch of old mud that's like 9 or 10 feet tall that you can kind of just barely get up on. And then that's where we were able to set up the camp. And the camp is just a piece of plastic on the ground with a piece of plastic attached to some bolts in the wall. So there's kind of some walls. And that camp is still down there. We didn't leave any of the gear at all down there. We pulled all the sleeping bags. All that gear has been removed. The only thing that is down there is there's a rescue cache, a waterproof drum with some rescue gears, some supplies, some warming stuff, maybe like an emergency bag, and then just the walls and the floor of that structure is there, and that's planning on being used again in 2021 if the trip occurs.
Wow, that's awesome. When I did Bighorn Caverns, there was a couple gals from Virginia that were part of MCC or AmeriCorps, mm-hmm. I think, and they were mapping caves. And it sounded like out there that they were just super muddy caves.
Yeah.
Like they were really impressed with our caves.
Yes, that's very true. So if you look at like TAG, Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia, that's where the majority of caves in America are. Tennessee has over 10,000 known caves. Just Tennessee. They have counties with more caves than all of Montana. Yeah, so they have tons of caves down there, but all their caves are basically a sewer system. It's basically what their caves are. So there's like, you find trash in them. They're all covered in mud. Everything's covered in mud. Even if you see formations, they're all muddy. There's not anything that's like colorful. Some of the people that I know that were exploring Binkley Caverns in Indiana found brand new virgin cave passage. No one had ever been down it. There were tires in it.
Wow, that's terrible. Gross.
Yeah, so it's a different scene for sure, you know. But think of how lucky they are. They can like they'll get done with work and they'll be like, "Oh, I'm just going to stop, go on a 2-hour cave trip because the cave entrance is a 2-foot walk from the car." And then they can do all this fun caving, be back and then have dinner, you know. Like so it's a totally different scene. It's I don't want to dog it too much, you know, because it's got a lot of positives too, I think.
It would be cool to have a cave under your house if there's that many, you know.
Oh gosh. Property, yeah. That'd be really cool. There was actually in the NSS news, I think it was this year, there was an advertisement for someone was selling a cave house, a house that was made into a cave.
I think I've seen a few of those pop up.
Yeah.
That would be cool.
Mm-hmm. I think
might not be super structurally sound.
I think the humidity is the biggest issue. You know, you just like.
Yeah, that's interesting that there is 99% humidity. Were you talking about down in Grand Canyon?
No, those caves are actually really dry. That was New Mexico. That Lechuguilla cave is pretty special. Yeah, that cave is unlike most. I think it's got It was the,
because I always view caves as being, yeah, a little bit wet, but also super cold. And so 60 degrees, 99% humidity. Yeah, that sounds like a sauna.
Yeah, it really is. So caves are the average temperature of the outside. So just whatever the mean temperature of their location is, that's what the inside of the cave is going to be.
Okay. So that's all that just because the air comes in.
Yeah, exactly. Just over a long period of time, it just averages out.
Huh. Super interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Isn't that cool? Yes.
That's cool.
There. But yeah. It's really neat. So even in caves where there's like Jewel Cave, there's 40 mile per hour wind flow at some spot. You know, that's a there's a tremendous amount of wind. But even then, the wind is always the cave temperature. It doesn't take very long for that for the air to equal the cave temperature. So then, are you familiar with chimney effect?
Maybe like a suction type thing. Is that what you mean?
So it's the same reason that they have the tubes in the in those earthships. It's the same thing. Okay. It's that if you have a hole up high and a hole down low, hot air rises and cold air sinks. So if you know, like if it's hot out, the tube itself is going to be cold, so it'll cool off the air and then it'll sink. So you need to have that, like, you know. So anyway, caves do that too with multiple entrances. Wow. So one of the things that we'll find is, like, this happened to me. I was in Fossil Mountain Ice Cave this past fall, and the airflow switched direction. So there's an upper entrance and an lower entrance, and if the airflow switched direction, that means the outside temperature surpassed the threshold that the cave was at. So the outside air temperature actually got colder than the cave, and that's an ice cave. It's in the 30s. So then we got to the exit, and there was snow. It was snowing.
So you knew.
It was like, oh, yeah. But we had, as soon as the airflow changed, funny. I was like, oh, that's this isn't going to be fun when we leave this cave all cold and wet.
Which cave in Montana or close to Montana has the best formations, do you think?
Easily Bighorn Caverns.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Sweet. And we didn't end up going too far when I went, so I'm definitely looking forward to going again. Because
did you get to the Mindbender Pools?
Yeah, in Horse Thief I did, yes.
Yep. Okay, cool. That's probably so. One of the more spectacular spots in the cave. There are other really nice ones, too.
It reminded me a lot
too.
Of, like, Lewis and Clark Caverns, you know, in that spot. Yeah, mm-hmm. So I did make it to mm-hmm. there.
Okay, awesome.
I did end up at a point in which I couldn't get further up there. There's, after you go through the tunnel, you go past those pools, you go around, and then there's this pretty tight.
Oh, the crack where the water comes down.
Yeah, the crack, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that thing is intimidating as all hell, too.
Yeah, I tried. Couldn't do it.
Yeah. No, it's like the chest gets stuck in there. Yeah. For a lot of folks, you can't have your head straight. You have to have your head turned to the side for a period of that, and then you have to commit to having it turned either left or right before you get through that constriction, before you can turn it again.
Yeah, absolutely. We need some tiny people in our group.
I know. Well,
you can get further.
Yeah. So all, some of my friends are having kids now, so, you know, like, we can maybe utilize that resource.
Get in there, draw some dots.
Yeah, exactly. Just come back when you're done, please. They also, one of the things that I think will be really cool that I haven't tried yet is, but you can get them for, like, next to nothing. You've probably seen them. They have these little, like, cameras with lights on them that plug into your phone that have, like, a 9 or 10 foot little flexible thing that you could shove
totally.
Into
like a little tube camera.
Exactly. I think those would be really, really nice sometimes too, you know. So I haven't seen anyone use those caving, but I'm sure people are.
Wonder how long you could buy them for. I bet you can get them really, really long and just snake them.
Yeah, I mean, just get a USB extension cable, right? Like, as long as the wire is thick enough, it shouldn't be an issue.
Use some IT knowledge down there.
Yeah. Well, that's what's really fun. That's one of the things, you know, like we use new surveying used to use these like analog mechanical survey devices when I started Suunto Tandems. And you hold it up to your eye, look through the eyepiece and try and line up with the point, and they'd be holding a flashlight on the point, and you'd be like, okay, I think it's this. Now we're lucky enough that there are $600 to $700 electronic instruments that do that for us.
Yeah, absolutely. How much is LIDAR, by the way? Pretty expensive.
So I've LIDAR'd a cave with a handheld LIDAR device before, and it was a $40,000 device when I used it in 2017. And then the software to post-process the data that it gathered also cost about 10 or 15 grand. And it was really cool. It looked like Ghostbusters. It had a little spinning dial on the front that you held, and it was connected to a backpack. So as long as you were like walking passage, it worked pretty well, but it didn't work very well in crawling passage because you'd have to hold that spinning device as you're crawling. And all of a sudden, you know, that got to be a lot more difficult. Yeah. And that was like, that was in 2016. That was top of the line stuff back then. That's probably better stuff now, but they were primarily the industry that was using that was like mining, tunnels and stuff like that. And they could still only do 300 feet at a time. So you would go up to 300 feet forward and then backwards, you would retrace those steps. I think the next planes are cool. Oh yeah, exactly. I mean, dude, you can get LiDAR that's built into your robot vacuum now. Have you really? Seen that?
No. Yeah. Robot vacuum?
Like, dude, I'm telling you, like $350, you can get a LiDAR robot vacuum.
Why?
Right now, it will map your house with LiDAR.
Wow.
Because it won't miss
any
spots. And your
phones have like a little LiDAR on it.
Oh yeah, yeah. My Pixel 4 actually has LiDAR on the top. Yeah.
Oh okay.
Yeah.
So maybe totally. It'll get cheaper. That'd be
yeah.
Sweet.
It will. I think my guess is 5 to 10 years, and we'll just be using LiDAR to map cave systems
and finding new ones potentially. Huh?
Yeah, exactly. So that's, I know the USGS has a goal to LIDAR all of their, everything that they have, all of their proper, you know, all the federal property, but I don't think they've done very much in Montana at all. So unfortunately there's not a lot of LIDAR data available for Montana stuff yet, but there, I'm sure there will be. It's just a matter of time. And then as soon as, you know, like as drones get cheaper, you'll just be able to throw a LIDAR unit on your drone and LIDAR your own area. Like that's all coming.
That'd be cool. I grew up drilling wells. I'm a family drilling business, and I always wanted to go to a place where there's caverns, because we do hit caves a lot when you drill. And it's really bad. So sometimes we don't drill in a certain area, because if you hit a cave, you lose all your air pressure, get stuck. But I always wanted to drill a really wide, really big well and then go down it. That'd be kind of fun.
Have you heard of Edgewater Caverns?
Uh-uh.
That's in New Mexico, and that's where they drilled, I think, an 18-inch hole to get into a cave system that's 100 feet deep, something like that.
That'd be kind of terrifying, because you had no idea what's down there. You know, no oxygen, potentially.
When I was working in drilling, I was only working in North Dakota, and I asked them, they never hit voids in North Dakota at all. None of those drillers ever did. But when I did work with a couple rigs that were in the Bighorn Basin out kind of towards Bridger, Montana, but in Wyoming, and they said that they hit a couple voids in the Madison Limestone that were like 5-10 feet deep. And then I was like, oh shit, where's the Madison Limestone? And he's like, that's proprietary, dude. I was like, damn it. But he's like, it's way too deep for you. All you need to know is it's like way deeper than you're gonna go. I was like, okay.
Yeah, true. Fair enough. We should be recording every time we hit a void. Put a little map on the map.
I know, right? Where were you guys drilling mostly?
Well, Helena area a lot, but if you get out to where like Lewis and Clark Caverns are in that whole formation, you hit them every time, basically.
Is it all oil and gas stuff?
Oh, no, water. Water.
Water? Oh, okay. That makes sense. Okay. Yeah. That makes more sense. I dreamed, I'm sure I'll never be able to do this, but I thought it'd be so cool to get property somewhere that has hot water underneath it and then figure out how to drill into that, make your own hot spring.
That would be cool. Or have like a turbine on it to get endless energy if you drilled it by Yellowstone or something. Yeah, that'd be cool.
I wonder if like ground penetrating radar or something will help with any of that in the future too. Maybe.
Maybe. Just for nerds that want their own.
Yeah. Well, you should just refer them to that like Russian thing where they tried to drill as deep as they possibly could. Just be like, yeah, you guys, you can get hot. You just got to drill real deep.
Yeah. Where was that? That was in Russia? They tried drilling as deep as possible, huh?
Yeah. They tried drilling the deepest hole they possibly could. And in the end, the drill bit always melts, I think.
Wow.
I don't remember how far they... Yeah. I don't remember how far they went, but I think it was like, it wasn't as far as you'd think. It was like 4-6 miles or 8 miles. It was like not that far. I know in North Dakota, they're going 4 miles, but they're only going 2 miles down and then 2 miles horizontal.
That's not the same.
Yeah. Just 4 miles. But yeah, so I think this one in Russia was like, it wasn't that, they thought they were going to get way deeper and they tried for a while. They like kept like trying. They're like, okay, we'll try different stuff. And yeah, they just ended up, it turns out it's hard to drill into the mantle.
Yeah, no kidding. We're going to have to find a metal that doesn't melt.
Yeah. Something. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, yeah, I just, you know, you go deep at some point. I think like once you get like same with like those mines. You look at like the diamond mines in South Africa and stuff, the deeper they go, the hotter it gets.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Well, thank you for being with me and discussing Tears of Turtle Cave and caving fun.
Absolutely. It was a ton of fun. And I just can't wait till we can all, as a group, get together again and start, you know, feeling the Dr. Seuss land again, man. I'm really looking forward to
same.
To that. That's what got me into caving. You know, once I started becoming a caver and then I met other cavers, I was like, wow, these people are really nerdy just like me. So that you know, the social aspect of it to me is, you know, the friendships I've made, the cool people that I continue to meet, such as yourself and everybody else, is really the biggest part of it to me, I think, now even more so than anything else. So I really look forward to that, and I can't wait till we can as a grotto and just, you know, meet. And on that note, our plan is to host a annual grotto meeting in June. We're trying to get access to a big barn where we can, hopefully people can be vaccinated by them, but if they're not, we can still have opportunity for everybody to socially distance and do that. So we're thinking we can't really do it in the winter because everyone wants to huddle up and be warm. So yeah, so that's the plan for the grotto here in Montana going forward, is June to have our annual meeting, and then hopefully we can plan our cave camp event for October again.
That's great. I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you for listening to the Mountains and Mushrooms podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast on all the major podcast sites. Consider supporting this podcast at patreon.com/mountainsandmushrooms.